Senate puts a stop to filibusters. President Obama's poll numbers take a hit over Obamacare. And Governor Walker begins his unintimidated tour. Those are some of the stories we'll be covering this hour in our Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have two guests with us from different political viewpoints to talk with you about the news of the week. And we welcome you to add to our list at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guests. We have with us Steve Prestigard. He is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Rick. I think it's morning anyway. It's all white outside, and not sure what that is.
Well, Steve, I know you're up late doing some kind of sports play-by-play. What's up here?
Well, that's right. I announced the WIAA Division IV football championship game last night, which was two teams combining nine total losses, Platteville and Winnicott. The Platteville people were not happy with losing, but the fact that both teams got to state was remarkable. Winnicott became the first team in the history of the high school football playoffs for the state of Wisconsin to have a losing record, still get into the playoffs, and win the state championship. So if you're in Winnicott, you're very happy, although I think pretty tired this morning. Platteville is quite an accomplishment merely to get to state.
Way to go, Winnicott. Let me welcome in our other guest, our other Week in Reviewer, Georgia Durst-Lotti, professor of political science at Beloit College. Good morning, Georgia.
Good morning. And my son's team lost to Platteville back a few years ago when they were going to state. So go, Winnicott.
Not that you're bitter or anything, right?
No, it was an exciting season.
Now, Georgia, you woke up to a blanket of snow in Beloit, I believe, too?
Yeah, I actually live in Evansville, and I looked at this snow and know that my brothers and nephews and a couple of nieces are amassing for deer hunting, and this is perfect tracking snow.
Yeah, they like it for the deer hunting. Are you a deer hunter, Steve? I didn't think you were.
I'm not, although I'm not opposed to deer hunting. My thing is I don't like getting up early, therefore I'm kind of not real built for deer hunting. I also have really, really bad hand-eye coordination, so I'd probably be more a danger to myself than the deer if I was out there.
Well, good luck to the deer hunters who are headed out for opening day tomorrow.
Yes, and if anybody wants to donate venison sausage to me, they can reach me on my website, steveprestigard.com, and I'll gladly take that.
All right, well, now to a much more solemn issue. 50 years ago today, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. There are memorials scheduled today in Dallas. There will be a solemn ceremony in Dallas marking the event. I'm just thinking, I don't know, Georgia Durst-Lotti, do you have thoughts on this, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Oh, I have many, and I've been interviewed to have many as well. Two things stand out. One, this really was the moment when we collectively shared grief on TV, the very first moment. And I remember this vividly as a child. So we have been doing this collective grief sharing on TV ever since when major events come along, and this was the first. But for JFK himself, think about what he said and how he inspired people to believe that government could do for us, and that it was a good thing to do government service and noble profession, something that would move the United States ahead and attract some of the very best and brightest people. And when we look at the absolute disdain in the rhetoric towards public employees right now, I have to remark upon how far we've come in a direction that I don't like. I'm with Kennedy. You know, how can we make government great?
Yeah. So, Steve, your thoughts on this day?
Well, the first thing is, as a student at John F. Kennedy Elementary School in Madison during the 1970s, I have a huge amount of interest in the assassination, particularly as a media geek, how it was covered. There is a site, his name is David Von Pine, I believe it is, P-E-I-N, the last name, on YouTube. And it is, to me, absolutely fascinating to watch this thing be covered by people who had, nobody had ever heard of them before the assassination started. And it is mind-boggling the number of people who made careers based on their work during the assassination coverage. And, you know, Bob Schieffer, I believe, still works for CBS. He was a newspaper reporter in Fort Worth on November 22nd, 1963, of course. Robert McNeil from the McNeil Era Report on PBS, he was working for NBC at the time. Dan Rather was a, he was a reporter in New Orleans, I believe, that had gone to Dallas. And, you know, to, the number of people who had careers started as a result of that event is remarkable. The media coverage, to me, is much more interesting than the reality. You know, Georgia made a comment about the value of public service. I guess it's really easy for, you know, John F. Kennedy, who came from one of the richest families in the United States, to tell other people that they ought to go into public service. You know, he didn't have to deal with things like that because his father made, you know, tons of money in less than perhaps completely legal senses. But be that as it may, I think that the John F. Kennedy that people idolize is not the John F. Kennedy that actually existed. For one thing, if you look at his actual record as president, it's a good deal more conservative than people want to believe it is. You know, when he was assassinated, he had a large tax cut that he was trying to get Congress to move on. He said the correct things about civil rights. The truth of the matter is, because he was one of the most cynical presidents we've ever had, he was, you know, his interest was as much about getting more voters for the Democratic Party than it was the cause of civil rights. And, you know, I think the lifestyle stuff, if you want to put it that way, kind of speaks for itself.
We have so many other issues. I don't know if we need to spend a great deal of time on the legacy of JFK in Washington, though.
Is that what people think it is?
President Obama will be meeting privately at the White House with leaders and volunteers from the Peace Corps program, which President Kennedy created. So that's going on today in Washington. Georgia, do you briefly want to touch on the what Steve just said?
It is true that he was very much a hawk when it came to communism. I think one needs to look at his presidency, marking it before and after the Cuban Missile Crisis. He really shifted gears after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I believe became a better president. I don't think he was good at getting things onto the agenda, and many of those things probably would not have been able to be accomplished in civil rights, for example, by a Northeast liberal. It took LBJ, and for that matter, Lady Bird, who worked very hard on civil rights, to go out and actually complete those tasks. So it was rather like Nixon going to China. We needed LBJ to put the civil rights into place. But LBJ would not have put it on the agenda.
Well, let's get to some of the other news from the week. Just yesterday, the U.S. Senate voted 52-48 to weaken the power of the filibuster. So now it will be harder for Republicans to block nominees for judges and other posts. President Obama applauded the Senate, saying the GOP pattern isn't normal and isn't based on substantive differences over his nominees. And it's time for the majority to rule here. Steve Prestigard, what's your reaction to what the Senate did yesterday?
You know, I think this is an excellent example of how arrogant politicians become from either party or no party. And pretty much in every level of government. I'm familiar, for instance, with a town board that essentially is trying to shut off commentary from people who don't agree with the people who are on the town board. Now, what does that have to do with the Senate? The Senate is supposed to have been about preserving the rights of the minority party in the Senate. You know, the House, similar to the state assembly, is a dictatorship of the majority. Whatever the majority wants, it happens. And I think it is amazingly nearsighted for Harry Reid and the Democrats to believe, I'm sorry, Harry Reid and the Democrats, that demonstrates I haven't gotten a lot of sleep, Harry Reid and the Democrats to think that this is never, ever going to come back and bite them, you know, to think that Democrats will always have the advantage, you know, the majority in the Senate. You know for a fact that the Republicans, the next time that they get majority control of the U.S. Senate, they're going to decide, hey, we don't need to deal with this filibuster stuff anymore. We do whatever we want. We don't have to even consider what the minority party has to say. And, you know, Pandora's box, I think, is just exactly what the Democrats opened up yesterday.
Well, I heard some commentators, Georgia Durislati, coming from the conservative side of the aisle, saying that this is just like a very sad day for democracy, and that this is hugely significant what the Senate did yesterday. What are your thoughts on what the Senate did?
It absolutely is hugely significant, and I should note that Reid et al. Were very careful to only use this change for appointees. And we can talk about the ways in which when a president gets elected, he's supposed to be able to put his own team in place, and something has really gone awry in this. In fact, Senator Feingold voted against everyone else in his party at one point for Ashcroft. Because he said, you know, the president is elected, let him put his team together, and only in cases of, say, criminality or total incompetence should someone not be allowed to go in if the president wants it. And with the judiciary, we can see a little bit more reason for higher levels of scrutiny by the Senate in terms of advice and consent. The trouble is, nothing was happening here. So many appointees were blocked in a true break in the historic pattern that I am for this particular change. It can be reversed by a majority vote. So if the Republicans agree to be a bit more governing rather than obstructionist, it can be changed back. The one fact I will point out is the Democrats seriously blocked Bush appointees while he was a lame duck. And that started this pattern in as earnest of measure as it was. But if you look at the history here, the first time that it really escalated was the Republicans, the first term of Clinton. So this blocking has been something that we see Republicans escalating back in Clinton's era, and it really has run amok in the Obama administration. And I'm glad they did something. Let's get on with governing.
We will take a couple of calls on the filibuster story and talk about other news of the week as we continue talking with Georgia Durislati, a professor of political science at Beloit College, and Steve Prestigard, journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com, about the top state, national, and international news of the week. If there's something that happened in the news this week that you would like to have our guests address, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll certainly talk about Obamacare problems and the politics of the Affordable Care Act. And we'll talk about Governor Walker, who says the launch of his new book isn't necessarily the launch of a presidential campaign. We'll see what our guests think about that as well as we go along on the Weekend Review here on the Ideas Network. This This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, along with two guests from different political viewpoints, talking with you about the news of the week. Today we have with us Steve Prestigard and Georgia Durst-Lottie. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take some calls. Randy in Keewascom is first. Hello, Randy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Basically, this vote was pure partisan politics so they could get some more partisans on the bench. I mean, Georgia talks about Senator Feingold, but and Ashcroft. What about all the extremely qualified judges that he voted against purely on political matters? The other thing is, remember, the Democrats are responsible for a new word in the vocabulary, borking. Anybody they don't like, they destroy. So if they can't just vote against them, they destroy them. You know, they're great at escalating stuff and then blaming it on the Republicans. I think they're worried that they're going to lose their majorities because people are getting to see all the lies that they told about the Unaffordable Care Act, and they want to get some judges in so they can have some people that do like what happened in Wisconsin. You have a handful of Madison judges that basically make judgments on their opinions rather than on the law and hold up laws from getting implemented.
Thank you very much, Randy. Well, Georgia, you want to address what Randy said?
It is true that borking came in under Nixon, but if you look at the ways in which this pattern emerges, there can be no doubt that both sides have participated in it, and I don't think Randy would agree that both sides have participated in it. However, if you look at the pattern more recently, it really is out of whack. And yes, to put partisans on the bench, certainly going back at least to Ronald Reagan, who began some serious litmus tests that were new in modern history for judicial appointees. That is one of the lasting legacies of a presidency, who they put on the bench. And so it's not a surprise that there is a partisan awareness of what happens on the bench and the importance of the judiciary for long-term policy. But we really have changed things, and the Republicans really are particularly obstructionist right now.
We're going to take another call with a different viewpoint, and then we'll have Steve react to Ned in Lake Dubay. Hello, Ned.
Hi. I take a different point of view. First of all, this is a very limited scope. The ability to cut off the filibuster with 51 votes instead of 60 is limited to the judicial appointments that are not the Supreme Court. It does not apply to other bills. It's just this backlog of judicial appointments that have been held up for an extraordinary amount of time. NPR has shown and did a nice little study recently about the much longer time for Obama appointments to be approved than under George W. Bush. It was like two or three times longer on the average. And so it's really unconscionable to give this wonderful ability of senators in, giving them their due respect so that they can hold up appointments. This is something left over from really a long time ago when senators were more honorable than they are today.
All right. Thank you very much, Ned. So, Steve, what's the deal? The Republicans are just blocking Obama's appointments way more than in the past, and this needed to be done.
Well, of course they are. It is politics. Let's keep this in mind. What we're talking about is lifetime appointees, as in they can be judges as long as they want. They can make as stupid or whacked out or as left-wing decisions. And take a look at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, for instance, and on the West Coast. Those people are insane on that Court of Appeals, and every single one of them is there for the entirety of their lifetimes or until they decide they're tired of being left-wing judges. So are the Republicans being obstructionists? Of course they are. all of the people who got elected to the Senate got elected because a majority of people in those states who voted support what they do. So, of course, it is. Now, if you want to have a constructive change about all of this, instead of the filibuster, maybe what we ought to talk about is asking the question of whether or not judges should be should have lifetime appointments when they have literally the power of life or death over people. In the case of federal criminal cases, should those people literally be 100% completely unaccountable to the people who are paying their salaries? That's a more interesting question, and that's not a question that's going to be asked, but, you know, that's...
Well, it's not a question I'm going to ask on the Week in Review because it's not what happened on the, during this particular week. We need to move into some other issues. It was a big week for Governor Scott Walker. His book, Unintimidated, was officially released on Tuesday. And the governor is on a book tour, talking with a lot of national media. Many people are speculating that this is just a first step on his way to a presidential run, though the governor insists that this is not a campaign book. He also, though, is not promising to fulfill a full term, a second term as governor, if reelected next year. Georgia Durislati, what is your thought here? Is Governor Walker going to run for president in 2016?
I have published many times on the full election cycle of a president, and he is certainly doing everything at this stage of a presidential election cycle that would suggest he is trying to be a candidate. He won't say that he's going to be a candidate at this point because partly he's testing the waters right now. But to go out and to get this kind of attention, to use a book release to do it, is exactly what they do. Of course, this follows on the heels of his being, for at least some period of time, out of the state doing national fundraisers for himself rather than in the state. So if he's not trying to run for president, then he should get back here and be governor more.
So, Steve, your prediction is the governor, does the governor want to run for president?
Well, he might want to run for president. I actually don't think he's going to run for president. I know I've said this before, but I think that the chance of anybody from the state of Wisconsin ever being elected president is absolutely positively zero. There's not a single person in Wisconsin politics who can raise enough money to make a credible run for president. You know, Tommy Thompson, longest serving governor in the history of this state, and he was a presidential candidate for what, like a month or something like that? If somebody like him is unable to do it, Walker certainly not, because he doesn't have the kind of personal wealth and he doesn't have the kind of connections to be able to do it. He's on a book tour. Well, what a surprise. People who are authors are on book tours. I've seen a little bit of the book, and it's a somewhat interesting read. There's some, in fact, revelations that Walker apparently wanted to get rid of public sector unions entirely. And, of course, his party wasn't interested in doing that. But, no, he's not going to run. That is my answer.
Did you think there was any interesting unknown information out of the book, Georgia Durislati? I know you haven't read it probably, but
no,
the media coverage of it.
I haven't read it, but it surely is getting the kind of coverage. I mean, I think that it, you know, the Democrats are trying to make hay out of some parts, such as trying to eliminate public employee unions entirely. The pledges that were made, the strategies that were laid out and said that play very well to the Koch brothers, and I happen to disagree that he doesn't have the national capacity to raise that kind of money. He certainly does because he got it through the recall election. He made those connections during the recall election. So, I mean, I think that there are some things in here that that show just how determined he is to, in my estimation, undercut the things that made Wisconsin's good government good.
Well, Democratic Party Chair Mike Tate is not too impressed with the governor's book. For one thing, he says there's no mention of Walker's 250,000 jobs pledge. And according to some new numbers from the Department of Workforce Development out this week, only 24,000 private sector jobs were created between June of 2012 and June of 2013. Only 63,000 over the first 2 years of his term. Steve, how big a problem will jobs be to Walker and his political ambitions, be it governor or president?
Well, let's see. We're talking about somebody who has not made a, not reached his pledge, and to be honest, I'll probably want to create, to have 250,000 jobs created. In contrast, we have the previous governor who's 8 years in office was resulted in six digits worth of jobs lost. And, you know, I don't think that there will be probably some voters who are not real pleased about the jobs situation. I think that, you know, maybe nobody should be real pleased about the job situation. But if not reaching a goal and ending up losing six digits worth of jobs in a state in just a couple of years, if you compare and contrast the two, my guess is Walker is going to be fine as far as that goes. You know, it's even in the private sector, you know, you're supposed to make big goals. If you don't make them, well, at least you made the effort.
And you can get fired.
in the private sector, maybe that's the case. Perhaps in the public sector, you don't, and maybe in certain parts of higher education, you don't. But private sector where you're working, yeah.
Georgia, what about the jobs pledge and our economic growth?
Yeah, first of all, let's just say it's easy to put out the glib line Steve just did about Doyle losing jobs, especially in 2 years. Go figure, it was during the heart of the downturn, unless you think Doyle is responsible for the national economic downturn. Then, you know, you are making a factual claim that is truly misleading. I do think that Walker is in trouble on the jobs. You know, he pledged this, and he spent so much time destroying jobs in the public sector, not realizing the ripple effect of those people spending money in the private sector. You know, I wonder what kind of economic theory he was operating by. I think it'll be some problem, but actually I think the whole thing is going to be overshadowed by the residuals of very, very fixed and hard feelings that came out of the recall and the kinds of actions that Walker and the Republicans did when they came, came in and started closing down the public sector in very important ways. I actually think that's going to override all the rest of it, even though he should be held accountable for too few jobs.
Time magazine is reporting that Governor Walker is thinking about going back to school to get his college degree. Walker talked to Time magazine, said he did not get his diploma from Marquette because he got a job from the Red Cross in his senior year. How big a deal is the college education, Georgia?
It will not play well in much of the country, but probably it doesn't matter for the core base of Republicans. Many, if you look at the street side Republican and some of the Tea Party Republicans, they don't particularly care about education anyway. So where it's not going to play well,
Steve.
It's not going to play well, it's not going to, you know, it won't matter to his base.
Steve?
What a bunch of snobbery that is. My goodness. As you know, and as a college graduate, by the way, I have to say that, you know, the reason that Democrats have problems in this country with the middle class, there's still a lot of people in this country who didn't finish college, some who didn't start college, some because they didn't have the money to. And to have this kind of, oh, I'm more important than you are because I have a college degree thing, that ought to be incredibly offensive to people listening to this program who don't have college degrees. One thing I can find, you know, having worked in private sector higher education, in the past is if you're an adult college student, you are a whole lot more motivated to get your degree finished than you are if you're the 18 to 22-year-old person who looks at college as a 4 or 5 year social thing. And I think that actually if he does go back and finish his degree, he could actually pick up a lot of pick up support from people who did not have the opportunity to finish college, and then as adults come back and say, maybe I need to get that degree after all. But to sit there with this snobbery, oh, he doesn't have a college degree, therefore he's stupid.
What I said is it's not going to matter in his base, and you just basically confirmed it, Steve.
That she said, yeah, I mean, isn't there, that's what she said, is that his base isn't going to care about that. That he doesn't have a college degree. It's not, I'm better than him because I have a college degree.
The thing is that in order to get the nomination, you can't just rely on your base because, you know, you're talking about, I can't imagine the numbers, but 20-25% of potential voters for any one particular candidate. You have to be more inclusive than that minimum to get the nomination. And, you know, one of the issues that Republicans have had for the past two election cycles, 08 and 12, is that they haven't reached the non-aligned independent voter who doesn't base things based on an R or D, but base things on, you know, what they feel about the person. So to say that it's not going to matter with the base, that doesn't matter all that much because you got to get voters beyond that, obviously.
Well, for what it's worth, the governor also told Time that he might get his degree in the next few years using the new UW Flex degree. Steve, should he get that degree or not?
I think it's kind of funny if, you know, he went to Marquette and then ends up getting a UW degree. That's kind of like John F. Kennedy's comment about getting a Harvard education and a Yale degree when he got an honorary one. But, yeah, he should. Mm-hmm.
Georgia, should he?
I think you ought to be focused on governing. If you are actually doing your own college work, it's a lot of work. You have to focus. I want him to focus on governing.
Well,
wait till he's done. Wait till he's done. You know, I'm happy he wants to finish. He's really, you know, pretty close. He can do it. My brother went back and did it. My sister went back and did it. I'm not, you know, absolutely. Adults who come back do generally focus more and get through faster, deeper kind of thing. But it's hard work to be in college, regardless of what it looks like from the outside. I want him to govern.
By the way, we will be talking with Governor Walker himself about Unintimidated, his book, on Wednesday, next week, Wednesday, from 8:30 until 9 o'clock in the morning. So we will talk with the governor about his book next week. This is The Week in Review. We are talking with Georgia Derslotti, a professor of political science at Beloit College, and Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com, about the top issues in the news this week. We'll talk some about, let's see, how about Obamacare coming up next? I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. You're listening to The Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, it's 45 North. 45 North will explore the emergence of online photo culture. We're all photographers now. Coming up on 45 North in our next hour. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, and you're tuned to the Ideas Network. And it's time now for our Week in Review quiz. A Green Bay couple is celebrating the birth of their baby boy, Aaron Roger Dreyer. Mom and dad named him after the Packers quarterback, who's currently on the sidelines recovering from a broken collarbone. What happened to make the parents call the baby Aaron Roger? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We will give you 5 minutes to guess or answer the quiz question. We'll randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers and reveal the winner and the answer at the end of the Week in Review. The winner will be given a choice of books that we have featured on the program recently. Let's talk a little bit more about the news of the week. The Wisconsin legislature is going to be taking up the badger care issue. It will convene next month. It decided to convene next month to take up bills that would extend health coverage for almost 100,000 people for another 3 months. Governor Walker toughened Medicaid eligibility in the state budget, forcing 77 people off the rolls as of January 1st. And Walker said that those people could find insurance through the new federal online exchange. But, of course, that online exchange has been fraught with problems. So the governor called a special legislative session so lawmakers can pass bills extending coverage to the groups who are losing their badger care coverage. Is the governor doing the right thing here, Georgia Durslotti, to extend the badger care for these people that were otherwise going to be off the rolls?
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to talk about this in a minute, but to say that the rollout of ACA is troubled is mild. So I actually am very surprised that he seems to be doing the right thing here. Of course, he would have political howls from the citizenry if people they know got kicked off the rolls and then weren't able to make the move to the ACA in a timely way. So it's good politics, but I was pleasantly surprised that he and the Republican legislature seem to be doing the right thing here after they kicked him off in the first place.
Well, Steve, should the legislature green light this request?
Well, isn't it remarkable what politics makes you do, to actually respond to people? So it is an effort to not have, people lose their coverage for the 3 months. Of course, I'm not the problem with that is that conceivably Obamacare is not going to be ready for them in another 3 months. So it'll be interesting to see what happens after this. But I mean, it's an obvious thing that you have to do.
Well, a new poll, actually a couple of polls have come out this week showing that President Obama and the Affordable Care Act are hitting record lows in public opinion. Just 37% of Americans approve of the job President Obama is doing as president. 57% disapprove of Obamacare. I mean, this is not this rocky rollout, Georgia Durslotti, has been particularly hard on the president, hasn't it?
Yes, and implementing any really big new policy is bound to be fraught with problems. And if we look at other recent big policies like rolling out TSA, there were many problems along the way. If you look at the way Massachusetts rolled out its statewide health care, 90-some percent of the people signed up in the last week. So, I wasn't surprised that there isn't a high sign-up rate. I am surprised at just how muddled the rollout is. This is not good, period. It just is not good. If you look at the numbers in those polls, the 35% or whatever it was, seems like they're the core Democrats. The 42 are the core Republicans plus some, probably about 5-7%, something like that. And so I think we're picking up as much support or rejection of Obama in those numbers. But frankly, it's not a good rollout.
Yeah, only 31% approve of Obamacare, 61% disapprove. Now, that's a turnaround. It used to be, at least in some polls, people wanted the Affordable Care Act. So how bad is this going to get?
Well, there's a difference between Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act. That's the confusion, right? There's been so much Republican rhetoric against Obamacare that the very same people who say they don't like Obamacare have said they do like the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, this is like one of those moments when you see the effect of partisan rhetoric on the public belief system.
Steve, your thoughts on the poll numbers?
I'm shocked at the 31% number. I'm surprised that there are 31% who actually support this train wreck that's going on. You know, it demonstrates that, first off, this was the wrong approach. In the state of Wisconsin, and I covered the health insurance and healthcare industry for a lot of years, when this, you know, in the days after Hillary Care failed, you might remember that 20 years ago, the important thing is to fix the problems, not completely change the system. What people are finding out, and the reason that the poll numbers are where they are, is that, first off, there is enormous sticker shock. It is, people just, you know, their eyes bug out when they see what this is going to cost them every month. The second thing is that apparently nobody in the Democratic Party bothered to tell voters that there would be people, there would be an order of magnitude more people who would have their insurance coverage canceled as a result of the supposedly Affordable Care Act than people who have signed up at this point. So you've got people who are finding out that coverage is going to cost incredibly more. I believe the number, I heard this last week, that for next year, apparently the average health insurance premium increase in this country is 40%, 40%. And then again, you've got all these people who are going to lose their coverage as a result of that. This was totally the wrong approach. And by the way, you know, since it's the federal government, you know, it's really not able to work even as it was supposed to work. I can't believe that there's 31% of people who actually support this mess.
Well, Georgia, besides the website issues, what about these other things Steve is talking about, the cost and the insurance policies being canceled? This, I mean, what's going to happen to turn around these poll numbers?
Well, the fact of the matter is where Democratic governors jumped in and worked with the federal government creating a well-integrated state program, we're not seeing these kinds of problems. And so it really is, again, a part of an effort to obstruct what's going on with this, and it's been very effective in slowing it down. If you look at the state of Wisconsin, we have allowed people to sign up for their existing health care early again. So many states with Republican governors are encouraging people to stay on their old system, and that's carrying through. It is true that the president spoke in blanket terms when he would have been much better off. The whole thing would have been much better off if he had said, 95% of you will see no change. Mm. And when the states jump on board, it will be easy. And the 5% of you with individual policies, take a look at them because we're actually going to improve what happens in those policies and make sure that they're covering everything and you don't get stuck when something happens to you that's outside of your system. And frankly, beyond that, the rest of us have to pick it up and pay for your bad insurance, which is the unstated part. So, you know, to have this all come together with the moving parts that are there, it was a conservative Heritage Foundation program that Obama went with. Frankly, I think we would have been better off with a single-payer system and then allow people to buy their own insurance beyond the single-payer system. That isn't what we got. We tried to do a compromise here, and it is not the best system it could be.
Well, what do you think this is going to mean for the 2014 midterm elections? Steve first.
Well, you remember the government shutdown, which seems like a really long time ago, but it wasn't, and how what a horrible disaster that was going to be for Republicans. And all of a sudden, nobody's talking about that anymore because that problem for Republicans has been replaced with, frankly, a bigger problem for Democrats. And now I think, and obviously a lot can happen in less than a year, but because of incredibly negative reaction, as it should be, to the disaster of Obamacare, added to the fact of the demographics of the 2014 election, which is everybody that got elected in 2008 when Obama got elected the first time, I think this is potentially, underline that word, going to end up losing the Senate for the Democrats, potentially.
Do you think so? Possibly, Georgia?
Well, if you look at the historic patterns, the off-year elections generally go against the sitting president's party. On the other hand, we saw the reverse happen at this point in the Clinton election, off-year election, and in the first Bush off-year election. So it still remains to be seen. I think that there's a lot of movement calling into question Tea Party candidates. I don't think that's going to change. It will depend upon just how solid Republican, because of partisan gerrymandering and redistricting, that I must say the Republicans did brilliantly, across the nation, in states across the nation. We'll just see how... whether or not that redistricting budges at all, whether or not reactions to Tea Party candidates as being so far out of the mainstream that we wonder what they're doing there. It'll be an interesting election. I actually don't think the Democrats are going to lose the Senate for and that, as Steve said, there's so much that will happen between now and then. It's really too early to know for sure.
State Republicans held on to a couple of vacant assembly seats in elections this week. One was Scott Suter's old seat in central Wisconsin. The other was Mark Honadel's seat in southern Milwaukee. There, Jesse Rodriguez, a pro-voucher school candidate, beat a Democratic community activist. Very briefly, because we're so short on time, Steve Prestigard, how significant are these two Republican wins for the Republicans?
Really not particularly, because they are holds. It's not like they flipped a seat. You know, you replace two Republicans with two Republicans.
Yeah. Well, then we'll leave it there, because it is time for us to congratulate Phyllis in Brookfield. She's our Week in Review quiz winner. We asked, why did a Green Bay couple name their newborn son after Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers? And I'll bet Steve knows.
It is because young Aaron Rodgers was during birth he got a broken collarbone. Of course, the older Aaron Rodgers got his in the game. The two things they have in common is neither are playing for the Packers Sunday.
That is correct, sir. The baby was injured during birth on Sunday. Doctors say this really isn't terribly uncommon. It was even on the same side that Rodgers injured earlier this month. Dad came up with the idea and says he won't be the least bit surprised if his son winds up on the gridiron someday. So yeah, there we go. All right.
Well, watch out for the blindside rushers.
Exactly. Well, go Pack and get well soon, Aaron Rodgers. Georgia Derslotti and Steve Prestigard, thank you both very much for being with us.
A pleasure.
Georgia Derslotti is a professor of political science at Beloit College. Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.